This is an ABC podcast.
This is ABC Australia Wide on ABC Radio.
When they talk about statistics, 4 in 6 months sounds so much more dramatic. But they're people. We're not statistics. They're families have lost their lives, and that's what I was freaking out. Every time it happens, it takes me right back to...
Leanne Drew worked in mining for 13 years. She's left the industry now, but her partner still works underground. She talks about the far-reaching impact of the recent deaths on Queensland mine sites. And Rural Fire Chief Doug Platt reflects on nearly 5 decades of service.
As far as the gear we were wearing, we had no safety equipment, no overalls, no helmets at that stage. If you were lucky, you might have had your workshop overalls, and they were usually covered in grease and petrol anyways.
What firefighting was like back in the day and what may need to happen in the future. Firstly today, we head to the Northern Territory. The looming closure of the Uluru climb has seen tourists and travellers flocking to the rock. 3 months out from the climb closure, campgrounds, roadhouses and hotels in the Red Centre are at capacity, and the climb itself is the busiest that locals have seen it. Samantha Johnshire has been following what's been happening at Uluru, and she joins Australia Wide. Samantha, what effect is this influx having on the area?
Hi, Alex. All these extra people coming into this area at once really is starting to take its toll. From witness accounts, there's just people are generating a lot more rubbish than we have the infrastructure to take care of. Caravan parks are full, campgrounds are full. People are even resorting when they arrive, if they don't have accommodation, to camping out on the side of the road in illegal spots, which means that they end up trespassing on pastoral properties or on traditionally managed areas. So, tourism operators are probably pretty happy to see these people, but I think it's also causing a bit of a nightmare on the ground.
We've seen a photo doing the rounds on social media in the last few days of a trail of people heading up the rock to do the climb, looking like ants up an anthill. It's quite an amazing photo. What concerns are there around the climb itself, given how many people are attempting it?
Well, the fact that it is so crowded does, increase the risk of something going wrong. I spoke to Glenn Minnett, who is a tourist from New South Wales, who was there. We spoke to him this morning. He did the climb yesterday.
Yeah, it was just madness. Like, one of my mates, he slid for nearly a metre, and because everyone was so close, he nearly cleaned up a young girl next to him. It's just how it was. Like you said, well, I couldn't help it, mate. I'm touching the person in front of me. I didn't mean to slide, but it was just madness, and it was definitely not safe with the numbers that were going up. Like, people were literally shoulder to shoulder, and if anyone that has walked it will know how steep it is.
That's tourist Glenn Minnett, who attempted the Uluru climb yesterday. Samantha, has there been any official response to safety concerns around the climb with this influx of tourists?
No, not really. Parks Australia doesn't take responsibility for anyone who climbs, and there's numerous signs around Uluru asking that people don't climb it out of respect for the traditional Anangu owners. People take their lives into their own hands when they decide to do that. What there has been a response to is the increased traffic, which is affecting, the campgrounds are full. The official accommodation is all full. Roadhouses around are also pretty full up at the moment. And there are steps being taken. There's been reports of rangers hurrying people along to make sure they don't stop anywhere that they're not meant to. There's been lots of information being provided to people about where there are legal free campsites. But there hasn't been an official response really to the climb situation.
Stephen Schwer is the chief executive of Tourism Central Australia. I guess he'd be pleased to see people coming to the territory. But what's been his reaction, I guess, to the way that it's been happening?
As you can imagine, extremely glad to see these kinds of numbers, but also somewhat disappointed in the number of people that are not respecting the landscape that they're entering into, and also the number of people that are arriving completely unprepared. We've heard numerous reports of people arriving into Uluru, even flying in and not having accommodation. So I spoke to him earlier today about what he had to say to those people.
They need to ask the questions at the information centres as they travel along the track so that those information centres can ensure that they've been able to be accommodated. Because where a lot of this comes from is people assuming that they will simply be able to find space. And when they can't find space, they find it themselves. And what they don't realise is that they're trespassing on protected land or they're trespassing on pastoral land.
That's Stephen Schwer, the Chief Executive of Tourism Central Australia. And just finally, Samantha, what are the locals saying about the numbers flocking to the area? What's their reaction?
Well, I mean, given that a lot of people in the area are either pastoralists or they do have a stake in the tourism industry, I think everyone's really happy to see these numbers. No one's disappointed. What people are disappointed in specifically is that people are not acting with respect. A number of pastoralists in the area have spoken pretty unfavorably about people, turning down a dirt road that's on their property and setting up camp, bush bashing or just turning off on the side of the road, all of which the pastoralists are concerned exposes them to risks. People are evacuating their black waste, which is the the human refuse in caravans on their properties, and they're also tracking weeds and who knows what else with them. And if you're a pastoralist, you're in charge of the weeds that are on your property, so that's putting them in a pretty hairy situation if you were to trespass and bring something nasty with you.
So are these numbers expected to continue for the coming months until we get to late October?
They're expected to stay pretty high, but once the school holidays finish next week, they're expected to ease.
It's providing some relief. Samantha Johnshire, thanks so much for joining Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
With me, Alex Hyman. Yesterday, we brought you the story of fatalities in the mining industry that have rocked communities across Queensland. It's caused anxiety and worry for many families who see their loved ones off to work long shifts. Leanne Drew worked in mining for 13 years. She's left the industry now and lives just north of Mackay. But her partner still works underground and many of her family members are miners. Leanne spoke with Angel Parsons about what impact these latest tragedies have had on her and many others in these mining communities.
Well, like everyone else, I'm just heartbroken and there are no words, and that's what I do. Sure. I speak. So I feel like the mining community or the mining industry is so small. We're like family. Each crew when you're working out there is your family. We spend half our life with them. They'd be, and I talk about this on the podcast, you've always got the ones you love, the crazy cousin, the uncle that you don't like, but we've all got to deal with each other. And people move from mine to mine, even from state to state, but there's always someone at that new mine that you go to that worked where you worked and, oh, remember old mate, oh, God, one of you clown, stuff like that. And to hear when something has happened and when you hear on the news that someone has died, your heart just sinks straight away. Straight away you think about, well, I do anyway, I'll just speak about for myself, think about my loved ones. This last fatality on a social media group, we saw that the mine he was in, someone said, well, it's not there. So I messaged mum and said, he's all right, her hubby. My partner was still working underground, real miner, so I didn't know if it was his mine or not. And then you start thinking about all the people that you know and your heart just goes out to the families, the crews of the people that work for them, the people that had to handle the incident, call the emergency, all the emergency response teams. My daughter's partner a few years ago, Big T, Tony, he died in a mine out at Daunia, and he was a much-loved supervisor out there. He wasn't killed in a incident. He had a heart attack and he died. He was down in that pit alone for a long time before they could, my daughter was his next of kin, but they couldn't contact her because she was down on the Sunshine Coast with her sister and they'd been out clubbing all night. So the phones weren't on and everything. So they contacted me and they came and knocked on the door and I had to find her and tell her. And she just fell on the ground and kept saying, what do you mean? What do you mean? And she's never been the same since. She's back up here, and after these four deaths, she's just told me last night that she's ready to talk to me about it.
Going now to this latest death that happened on Sunday, from when the first tidbits of information started floating around on social media to when it was actually confirmed was quite a long time, and your partner was underground on that day. Can you talk me through what was going on in your mind during those hours?
Well, it throws you for a six. I had my day planned. It was my day off, buzzing around, listening to the ABC, doing my chores. And I just spent most of the day in front of the computer, to be honest. I just started getting shaky and lots of swear words, lots of anger, lots of, are you freaking serious? It was only 1-2 weeks ago. And there was another one in February, and there was one on New Year's Eve, and there was a couple before that. But that's not in 6 months. So then say, just, you know, when they talk about statistics, 4 in 6 months sounds so much more dramatic. But they're people. We're not statistics. They're families have lost their lives, and that's what I was freaking out. Every time it happens, it takes me right back to when I was the one who had to ring my daughter and tell her about Tony.
That's Leanne Drew talking there to Angel Parsons in Mackay.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
To New South Wales now. The Rural Fire Service has been an integral part of Doug Platt's life since he first joined the organisation back in 1971. This month, Doug is stepping down as captain of his local Myla RFS Brigade on the New South Wales Southern Monero, a position he has held since 1991. Doug Platt's told Sophie Longdon that while plenty has changed since he joined the RFS nearly 50 years ago, the challenges of climate change and increased training requirements for volunteers are putting increasing pressure on local communities.
As far as the gear we're wearing, we've had no safety equipment, no overalls, no helmets at that stage. If you were lucky, you might have had your workshop overalls, and they were usually covered in grease and petrol anyway, so they didn't contribute much to protection. The equipment, this was in the early 70s, was mostly farm trucks, and they'd be equipped with two 1,300 litre tanks, or sometimes one tank and a pump, but a lot of hand tools and a box of matches, and that was about it. Communications was basically done by landline or sight. If you saw the smoke, you went. And if you didn't see the smoke, it was usually just done by landline. And it took a while to get equipment ready, because you had to find people out in the paddock, and then they had to, you know, set the old truck up and fill the tanks up. It was always a few hours before you got there, but you still got the fires out.
And in those early years, what were the sorts of conversations around fire and climate and bushfires particularly? Were they different from those that we're having today?
No, it wasn't so much different. Much the same, the impact of fire. The fire severity was just as severe as it is now. It's certainly now is changing, and as we're in a changing climate, the fire seasons are getting longer because our autumns are getting drier. The fire seasons are starting earlier because our late winter and early spring rains, we're getting a bit drier. So we're finding now that we're having to attend to more incidents in August, September.
As a farmer as well as a Rural Fire Service volunteer, what have your observations been around whether we're addressing those climatic changes correctly?
No, I don't think we are at this stage. I think we've got to go back to nearly square one and learn from the First Nation people how they went about managing the landscape. I think particularly as we're heading into climate change, we've got to head back and learn how they manage the landscape, particularly with Aboriginal fire stick burning, where you've got soft hazard reduction work constantly going on. I think we've got to learn to live with fire now, like the First Nation people did. And I think that should be taught in classrooms from the very beginning now, that we've got to learn how to manage the environment better and do it in a situation where it keeps reducing the fuel level, but also burn it in a soft way so that it keeps the country hydrated, so that the animals can get away from fire easily when you're doing hazard reduction. But we've certainly got to learn to live with fire in that sense. I think the whole community has to be involved in slashing and mulching and mowing and ploughing, whether it's on your own individual premises or if it's around towns, to reduce the impact of fire.
Of course, you would appreciate that a lot of the conversations around bureaucracy is to do with safety and keeping people safe and preventing injury and keeping communities safe. Is there a balance there, and have we got a little bit out of kilter?
Well, no, I think we've got way out of kilter. A lot of people in rural areas everywhere, they drive four-wheel drives all their life and in their work. They use chainsaws and pumps and fire, whether they're burning stubble or burning heaps or burning carcasses. They're using fire all the time themselves. They've got a lot of common sense. They're very capable people. And it's okay, yes, people that are not used to that, to train them up. But a lot of people in rural areas, you've got a huge educated common sense, the whole thing, that can go and put a fire out without all the red tape and the bureaucracy hounding them. It's using people's time, valuable time, more and more. And here that they put a huge amount of time into keeping trucks serviced and running. They put a huge amount of time into attending fires or doing hazard reduction work. And then on top of that, they've got to do all this excess training that's just, it is turning people off. And they face the risk, particularly in rural areas, of volunteer numbers dropping to the point where some brigades are going to be in real trouble.
That's outgoing Rural Fire Service Captain Doug Platts speaking there to Sophie Longdon.
ABC Australia Wide.
If you listen really, really hard to the wind that's blowing, you can hear the voices and there's a peace come over you.
On ABC Radio.
Alex Hyman here with you. Now, earlier this week, we heard about a $190 million class action in Queensland in regards to unpaid wages owed to Indigenous workers. In light of the events in Queensland, local Indigenous groups in Western Australia are set to follow suit with their own class actions. WA Stolen Generations Corporation Chairman Jim Morrison says the Queensland case creates an opportunity for those in WA.
It looks like a wonderful opportunity. It looks like a good opportunity for West Australians to think about what the impact has made in Queensland. Sure, a bigger population, but there's a huge population here too, you know, 80, 90,000. So we don't know the impact. We now know that probably half the Aboriginal population in Western Australia are stolen generation and or descendants. So the biggest state where removal took place. So you'd have to appreciate, I think, that with that removal and being put into missions, there was a lot of cases where our people went out to work and 75% of their wages was put into trust.
How far along are plans for a class action, similar class action in Western Australia?
I think pretty close. The Shine lawyers have been talking to me for the past 12 months, trying to work out ways and means to communicate with potential victims in WA. They've been to the Kimberley, they've been to the Pilbara, they're going to Kalgoorlie this week. And this week being NAIDOC, and the theme of NAIDOC is just amazing that it's so coincidental. So there's been a fair amount of travel by them. Two Aboriginal barristers, I understand, will be coming to Perth tomorrow and meeting with some of the people I've encouraged to participate in a discussion. That's 4:30 tomorrow and 8 o'clock the following day. So a couple of opportunities here. But really now it's about encouraging our mob to come forward, to actually register, to think about the potential for them, what their old people went through and what the potential is for their children.
That was Jim Morrison, chairman of the WA Stolen Generations Corporation, speaking to David Webber. WA Treasurer Ben Wyatt says he is expecting some sort of legal action.
In Western Australia, we've had a particular problem where we haven't had a lot of records around it, so it's been particularly difficult for people to make their case. But I suspect as a result of what's happened in Queensland and also the reforms that the Premier and Attorney General John Quigley have already announced to our laws around class actions, I'd expect that we'll probably see one in Western Australia in the not-too-distant future. So,
WA Treasurer Ben Wyatt there.
ABC Australia Wide.
The Developing Northern Australia Conference has kicked off this morning in Karratha in the Pilbara. This is the first time WA has held the conference that's seen industry leaders gathering to discuss issues affecting the north of WA, the Northern Territory and Queensland. Michelle Stanley has been at the first day of the conference today. Michelle, what are the main issues or themes that are being addressed?
Well, it's been really wide-ranging, actually, Alex. I mean, earlier this morning we heard about supply chain logistics and how to improve the supply chains to help develop Northern Australia. Later on, we have some chats about aquaculture development in the north, discussions around drought and different sorts of, I guess, different ways that each region, whether it be from the local towns and shires to greater industry, ways they're able to develop their part of Northern Australia, I suppose.
So who has travelled to attend this event?
All sorts. So I was just speaking a moment ago to a lady who works for the Queensland State Government. She's based in Brisbane in policy development for regional development across the state. We've got ministers, we've got people from the ag industries in WA, but also across the NT and Queensland. So it's a huge number of people, also people from the south of the state as well, talking about how they see, you know, leaders in the south can see that, you know, the ways Northern Australia might be able to learn from their lessons and mistakes in some cases.
Sue Middleton is a very prominent farmer in Western Australia. She is expected to make a fairly bold speech about northern development. What is she expected to raise in her address?
It's all about to negxit or not to negxit.
To negxit.
I guess is a play on words. Yeah, Brexit. So for Northern Australia to leave the rest of the country. Now, what she's really talking about is the fact that she doesn't think we need to be looking towards the government for development. She thinks that Northern Australia needs to rely on itself. And so not a physical, a secession, as we talk about in Western Australia, but just starting to rely on ourselves and not rely on the government. So it's a big topic up here. People would like more land opened up and more funding opened up and all these opportunities, but she's saying that maybe we should just be doing it ourselves and looking to other people to raise capital and other ways to bring the north forward, not to rely on those southerners.
Development of Australia's north can be a difficult issue politically, and the Nationals' Matt Canavan has weighed into this. What has he had to say to the conference?
Yeah, Federal Minister for Resources in Northern Australia, Matt Canavan, gave a video speech today. He wasn't able to make it. And I guess he began by talking about the bipartisan support that the plan for developing Northern Australia has and how people are starting to work together and see that over the next 30 years, I think there are about 26 years left in this plan, that we can develop the northern part of Australia. But he did sort of take aim at some of the environmental activists in his speech this morning and sort of said that really people in the north need to be listening to and paying attention to people in the north and not people trying to, I guess, have their political views heard when they're not really in this part of the world.
Let's have a listen to Matt Canavan.
I do think that with all the goodwill that we've got, with all the buy-in at the federal government level and through most states and territories, what remains the biggest barrier to development is an agenda being pushed by some that we shouldn't develop parts of our country, particularly some environmental activists that often don't live in Northern Australia but want to have a say, indeed want to have a veto about what happens in Northern Australia.
That's the Federal Minister for Resources and Northern Australia, Matt Canavan, there speaking to the Developing Northern Australia Conference in Karratha. And there is one more day left of the conference tomorrow. Michelle, what's expected to happen then?
We'll be talking a little bit about the Indigenous economic development in Northern Australia, which should be a really interesting chat from the North Australian Indigenous Land and Sea Management Alliance. Also a look at green hydrogen and green ammonia, which is basically using some of that incredible sun and wind that we have up here in the Pilbara and being able to export that as different sort of energy opportunities to southern Asian countries. So plenty of development and economic talk tomorrow, but hopefully it should be another good day here in Karratha.
Michelle Stanley, thanks for chatting to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Alex.
Michelle Stanley there in Karratha, and that's the program. I'll be back again tomorrow on Friday. Looking forward to your company then. My name's Alex Hyman. This has been Australia Wide. Thanks for your company. We'll catch you tomorrow.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.